This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. This is hour number two of the program. Producing for us, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we will be doing something we don't usually do, but we like to do when we have the chance, and that is to talk about music and even to play some music. And this morning, we will be talking about the making of a record that continues to be the best-selling classic jazz album ever. It also happens to be, of all of their records recorded by Miles Davis, his best-selling album. And the record we're talking about is Kind of Blue, which was released in August of 1959. And as of January 2002, it was certified triple platinum in sales. It is a record that I think probably for a lot of people who like jazz would be on their list of the best jazz records ever made. I suppose there would be some people who'd go as far as to say that it should be on anybody's list of the best records ever made. And we'll be talking this morning about this record and something about Miles Davis with Ashley Kahn. He is an award-winning journalist and radio essayist. He's the author of The House That Train Built and A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album. He's often heard talking about jazz on National Public Radio. And we're pleased to have him here on the program back with us again to talk about Kind of Blue. He's authored a book, by the way, that's all about the making of this album. It was first published in 2000 and now is out in an updated edition. The book is Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. DeCapo Press is the publisher. So if you're interested, you go out and take a look at the book. Questions are welcome as we talk. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you want to be involved in the conversation, you just pick up the telephone and give us the call. Mr. Kahn, hello.
Hey there, Dave.
Thanks for talking with us again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. You know, I think any time that I would be involved playing this parlor game about what records would you take with you to the desert island, this is the first thing that I would always think of before anything else. And I have to say that it's one of the records. I still say record. I have a compact disc that I listen to. One of the things that as many times as I have listened to it, I never get tired of it. It never gets old. And that's,
yeah,
you know, saying something.
Yeah, first of all, I think you wouldn't be alone. I think there are a lot of people out there who wouldn't even consider themselves jazz fans or jazz fanatics or jazz experts or whatever, who just love this album. Mm-hmm. I mean, it appeals to classical enthusiasts, rage rockers, hip-hoppers, you know. It has that ability to have that sort of universal appeal. And I also believe that, you know, it's like one of those albums that has found a way of speaking a language that anybody can understand.
Well, that gets to me what is a really big and basic question, and that is, what is it about this music that something about it is just timeless? It doesn't, you know, as much as I appreciate Miles Davis, I'm sure that there are some things that he's recorded in his life, that to me are difficult to listen to and also sound very dated in a sense.
Yeah.
And this record, it doesn't. It's almost outside of time. And I guess, it, you know, not being someone who really could take it apart musically and tell you why, that my question would be, why? What is it about this record that does that?
If there was a sort of definite thing you could point to and say, because of this, this, and this, it achieves that, then everybody would go and follow that formula and we'd have nothing but timeless music out there. It's nothing, it retains a certain mystery about it even as we celebrate it. And I don't think that we can point to this unbelievable sextet that he put together with the legends John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, Bill Evans as being the only reason that it achieved a timelessness, or the fact that it was done in an incredible studio at the height of the hi-fi era, when they were really, I mean, engineers were really incredibly adept at recording acoustic music, like in the late 50s. Because there was so much music from that era, too, that didn't achieve it. So it was just a combination of all these elements and some sort of harmonic convergence that comes together, and this happens every now and then. I think the way you put it just now about the idea that you can continue revisiting a masterpiece. Whether it's, you know, a canvas at the Louvre in Paris, or the Sistine Chapel in Italy, or, you know, some other type of music like Mozart's 41st, there's something about those works of art that stand up to revisitation, and that even as you continue to grow yourself, it speaks to you in different ways. And Kind of Blue is definitely in that category.
Miles Davis, I certainly think it's fair to say that he, among jazz musicians, he's one of the most popular, one of the most influential, one of the most distinctive in the sense that when you hear his music, you know who it is.
Oh, yeah.
How did that, in addition to all of that, someone who had the reputation of being difficult and fiercely individual and independent, and he was going to go his way no matter what, and if you were in the way, you'd better step out of the way.
I mean, he,
you know, that's the kind of guy
he was. He certainly had that reputation. I mean, he was an irascible genius, definitely. But even in his 20s, people were looking at him within the jazz community, even within the music community. There are a lot of classical and, you know, people in the classical world who were looking at him, and like Leonard Bernstein, were wondering where he was going, simply because he seemed to be carrying some sort of creative standard. And there are those type of people within the worlds of music, art, etc., who seem to be one step ahead of everyone else and have a crystal ball for the future or whatever. Whatever we think about his personality, I mean, if you read his autobiography, being a young, a determined and creative black man in 1940s America, you know, certainly left its mark on him, and he certainly was not one who was going to suffer racism gladly and other stuff that he came up against, music business practices. Nonetheless, despite all of that, the music transcends that. And if you think about his sound, especially in the 1950s, there's this emotional vulnerability that stands in stark contrast to the sort of seething personality that most people think of him as having.
Yeah.
He really was romantic deep down inside, and that's really what we remember him for.
Yeah.
Those ballads of the 1950s that he was doing, unbelievable.
Yeah, that's a certain kind of, and it seems that perhaps more than other musicians, you associate a certain kind of mood, and I don't know how many, in how many different records and in how many different tunes, somehow blue is attached to Miles Davis.
Very true.
But that a certain kind of emotional tone is really associated with him, and he probably put it across better than almost anybody I can think of.
You know, that sort of raw emotionalism has always been there in jazz, and you know, I mean, it gets polished up and arranged and smoothed over in many ways. But if you really want to, you know, look at the people that we revere as legends, whether it's Duke Ellington or Thelonious Monk, or all the way up to modern people like Joshua Redman or Ravi Coltrane, son of John Coltrane, there's a stark emotionalism that's there, and Miles was like the king of that.
I want to certainly want to play some music from Kind of Blue, but maybe before doing that, because I want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about how Kind of Blue was a departure, in a sense, goes in a different direction, that Miles goes in a different direction, and then he takes with him a lot of the jazz world also in a different direction, because it's a different kind of music. We had from our record collection here at the radio station two CDs that were recorded earlier, and the earliest one we have here is a record called Bag's Groove that was recorded in 1954.
Oh, nice.
And you suggested maybe we might play a little bit of the title track, Bag's Groove.
Sure.
Take one. So why don't we, and I'm not sure how long it is, so I'm not sure whether we play the whole thing or not, but we'll play some of this, and then we can talk a little bit about it. So again,
absolutely.
This is
great.
Bag's Groove.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Thank you. Okay, then I'm sorry to have to fade out on Miles there, but it's 11 minutes long, and we really couldn't play the whole thing. So that's Bagge's Groove, Take One, from 1954. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, I think that, you know, you can see that Miles always had a serious, serious deep roots in the blues. You know, and for your listening audience there in Chicago, in the Chicago area, I'm sure there's not much that I have to explain. I mean, he was from St. Louis. He grew up in the when blues, jazz, swing, R&B was all pretty much the same thing. And he was also about, as the title suggests, the groove, the sort of rhythmic swing, but a very relaxed sort of version of it. And this is coming out of the very energetic days of bebop, which was, you know, a much more finger-snapping and, you know, frenetic, almost, energy. And his answer to that was to find his own voice. There were so many other people who were following the ways of Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, who were the pioneers of the bebop movement in the 40s. Miles, at a very early age, is finding his own voice. His own voice on trumpet, which is much more relaxed, and his own voice as far as being a band leader and leading incredibly strong soloists and arrangers and composers like Milt Jackson, like Thelonious Monk, who's playing piano on that track, and establishing himself as a leader. So all that stuff comes to mind when I hear Bagge's Groove.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ashley Kahn. He's a journalist who writes a lot about music, jazz particularly, and he's the author of a book, Kind of Blue, The Making of Miles Davis Masterpiece. It's about the recording. It's a lot of it really is in a larger sense about Miles Davis and his life and his music, but particularly focuses on how it was that he made this particular record, Kind of Blue. It was recorded in two sessions in the spring of 1959, and as we said at the beginning of the program, would be on a lot of people's lists of the best records ever made. And it's something that is loved, widely loved by not only by people who love jazz, but just by people who love music. The book is just out. It originally was published in 2000 and now has come out in a kind of an updated edition with a new afterword. It's available in paperback by the DaCapo Press, so you can take a look at it. And of course, Kind of Blue is still in print, so if you want to listen to it, you can find a copy, I'm sure. Questions are welcome to 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, the record, as you said, I think that that he, like a lot of other musicians, had been working in bebop, and as you write in the book, we're getting unhappy with it. I don't know if they were tired of it. They felt limited by it. They wanted to do something different. And so he and other musicians went in this different direction, and it's something called modal jazz, and I'm not really sure I quite understand it. What is modal jazz?
Well, it's basically the idea of bebop is the idea of using harmonies as a sort of free as a way of freeing yourself to do these really complicated solos. Modal jazz is sort of like the answer to that, but in the opposite direction. It's like, okay, we can be as free and as improvisatory, we can do these great solos, but we don't have to keep changing the scales or the harmony. We can, like, rest and stay on a certain scale for a longer period of time, and in this way show off our individuality. One of the best examples I've heard of this is like, it's sort of like going to a house where a big party is going on, and in each room it's a different scale, and bebop was sort of running from one room to another to another to another, up to the attic, down to the basement, back up to the kitchen. And modal jazz was kind of like, let's go to the living room and hang out for a while.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I don't know if that helps, but
that's a good metaphor. I think it makes sense.
The point here, David, is that it's a device that musicians use to allow themselves to be more creative and find their own voice. That's what's important.
And I think that somehow we were talking earlier about the timeless quality. I think that kind of sensibility helps it. You know, because in a sense, the music just sort of seems to float. It's almost like it doesn't.
Perfect way of describing it. Yeah.
It's
a certain suspension.
Yeah,
that you feel there.
Yeah. Well, then why don't we go ahead and play something from Kind of Blue? I was thinking that we might play Blue and Green, and just because it's the shortest, and we can play it. We can play the whole thing.
Sure.
So let's do that. This is Blue and Green from Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. This was recorded in 19. This was one of the first session tunes. So this was recorded on March 2nd, 1959?
Yes.
Is that right? All right, here we go.
First session. Thank you.
All right, that's Blue in Green from Kinda Blue, Miles Davis album recorded in the spring of 1959. They're featuring Jimmy Cobb on drums, Paul Chambers on bass, Bill Evans, the pianist, Miles Davis on trumpet, and John Coltrane is the saxophonist on that particular cut. What would you like to say about that?
I'd just like to say that, you know, I mean, actually, this is probably the least modal jazz of the modal jazz tracks that are in Kind of Blue. Mm. But nonetheless, it just goes to show how he had this predetermined idea that all these tunes should fit in a sort of mood and that suspension that we were mentioning about before. And what this also brings to mind, you know, is in the research that I did for this book, the only surviving member of this group is Jimmy Cobb, the drummer. And I remember him going, Blue and Green, he's listening to it, and he just laughs, and he goes, you know what Miles told me, you know, what my instruction was and what to do on this tune? He comes over to me and whispers in my ear, he goes, I want a floating sound.
Hmm.
And he goes, okay, Miles, a floating sound. He goes, all right. But that whole idea of suspension and you know, keeping the music elevated and yet maintaining that sort of mysterioso late-night mood,
yeah,
is exactly what it's all,
yeah,
about.
And here, it really makes me want to have you talk about the contributions of Bill Evans. And I think you certainly, in the book, your point, I think, is that perhaps over time, his contributions to this record have been maybe underappreciated, undervalued. Certainly, he never really pushed himself up to the front, and I think initially Miles kind of actually pushed him to the back, and it always was, well, this was all out of Miles' head, and
yeah,
it was very spontaneous. It was unrehearsed. He just came in and gave a couple of vague instructions to the band, and they just went. And that's, none of that is true. And one really has to, when you listen, I guess to me, when I listen to this, as much as I'm hearing Miles Davis, I feel like I'm hearing Bill Evans.
Right. Well, I mean, certainly Jimmy Cobb put it perfectly. I mean, he said, you want to know about Bill Evans's role? Just listen to the album and listen to Bill Evans's music at the time, and you can hear that there's so much of Bill Evans's musical character in there. Let me say a couple of things, though, that Miles was not a total ogre about this, but he certainly was coming from a day and age where the band leader had that sort of droit de senior, the right of the leader to appropriate all material, all efforts that were done under the aegis of his band. Big band leaders, Benny Goodman, you know, Stan Kenton, etc., had sort of gone through that as well during their day. But things were changing in the 50s, and certainly by the 60s and 70s, the music business and the rights of individual writers and arrangers and composers, most pointedly in this case, were, you know, changing, and they were getting their due. Bill's, as you so accurately point out, Bill Evans's personality was certainly the type that was more retiring. He was not a confrontational type of guy, and is certainly with Miles, you know, you didn't want to confront him on these sort of matters. But to my ears, and to what I've been able to find out in the research and past interviews with Miles and Bill Evans himself, is that beating at the heart of Kind of Blue is the sort of relationship between two musical explorers, one black, one white, one very, you know, upfront type of personality, one more, you know, reticent in the case of Bill Evans. But that brotherhood between Miles and Bill Evans is really what makes Kind of Blue so incredible. And they only did it one time. Bill, of course, went on to do his own, you know, thing after Kind of Blue and pursue his own mostly trios, you know, through his career. In fact, the whole band was so bursting with talent, with A-list talent, that future leaders, John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, Wynton Kelly on piano also, on that one track, Freddie Freeloader, all these guys sort of had to break out on their own at a certain point. But for that one moment in time, and this sort of adds the whole sort of romantic aspect of the album too, for that one moment in time, they were able to all come together.
Yeah. Our guests in this hour of Focus 580 is Ashley Kahn. He's an award-winning journalist and radio essayist, has been heard often on National Public Radio. He's the author of The House That Train Built and A Love Supreme, the story of John Coltrane's signature album, and the book that we're talking about here this morning, Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. It is the story of that record, Kind of Blue, that was recorded in 1959. And as I said, here at a couple of points, a lot of people would say it's, if not the best jazz album ever recorded well, it certainly deserves a place as one of the best, something very, very special. It just doesn't happen all that often. And if you've never heard it, go out and just go out and buy yourself a copy. Okay, you won't regret it. I promise you.
Absolutely not. You know, the funny thing, David, is that Kind of Blue became the leading jazz album, best-selling catalog item, you know, within the jazz world, etc., long before the record company behind it, first Columbia Records, and then, of course, Columbia was bought out by Sony Music, but long before they discovered they had this little gem in their catalog and decided to really put promotional money or marketing money behind it, it's like the vox populi, you know, the people in their own right determined that this was going to be a best-selling classic album without any promotional help from the record company. And that, I think, makes it a much more natural type of, you know, masterpiece on its own.
These guys, when they recorded it, there were these two sessions, March 2nd, April 22nd. So it was recorded in a matter of a few hours. It was not a very lengthy undertaking. They did the one session and they did four tracks. They did the second and they came back and did two more, and that was it. And then they all went off and did what they were doing. Did they have the sense that they had done something very important here?
It was another day at work, you know. I mean, you know, I won't say it was another, you know, day at the salt mines or anything for them, because they, of course, musicians, especially on this level, on top tier of being in Miles Davis's band, etc. I mean, they were very proud of where they were and the type of music that they were doing. But this was, no, just another session. And if you talk to many of the musicians at the time, they go, listen, it's a great album, but it's not my favorite Miles Davis album. Or, you know, some of the musicians were actually on the album. They're like, you know, it's great that it's become, you know, the best-selling one, but you never would have gotten me to guess that on the afternoon when I put on my coat and walked out of the studio, you know, in 1959.
Does that reflect, sometimes I think, sometimes in jazz, I'm not sure that performers are always value the idea of accessibility, that maybe...
Well, I think you could sort of, you know, pull back and say that about jazz in general, and then it has this unfortunate reputation for being this top shelf type of thing that, you know, sort of like wine, you know, you have to read a book first before you can even approach the subject. And, you know, it's all about your ears. It's all about your heart, and, you know, does the music speak to your soul? And certainly the people who are making it are just like you and me, you know. They're just there wanting to express themselves, wanting to be creative, wanting to have the ability to blow their saxophone, play the drums, play bass, and you know, as well as put food on the table, as well as whatnot. We're all regular people, you know, doing, you know, speaking in the ways that we have been taught to speak and trying to find new ways to describe the same old things, basically.
Well, I'd like to play some more music, and I guess I picked Blue and Green just because it was the shortest cut, and I figured, well, we could play the whole thing.
Sure.
And as wonderful as that is, you said that that's probably the least modal piece on this record.
Right.
Now, I know in the book that you write that you think that Flamenco Sketches is probably the most modal piece. I don't know if you'd like to play that or play something. There'd be a different, and as my engineer in here, Jason Croft, he says to me, he says, well, you know, so what is the, you know, that's the signature piece, which is the first track.
So with that incredible, dreamy, smoky late night introduction where you just hear Bill Evans and Paul Chambers piano and bass kind of dream their way into the tune. and then the finger snapping part of it begins.
Yeah. Okay, well, now for Jason Croft and everybody else, why don't we do, let's play So What. This is the very first track, not the first one they recorded, but it's the first track on the album. This is So What from Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. That is So What. It's the first track on Miles Davis' album Kind of Blue, recorded in 1959. We're talking this morning with Ashley Kahn, who writes a lot about music, jazz in particular, and has a book that's all about the making of this album, Kind of Blue. Kind of Blue, the Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece is the title of the book, and it's published by DeCapo Press. Well, you want to say a couple things about that track?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that I always kind of laugh about and makes me smile about that tune is how unbelievably dismissive the title is. So What?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you kind of hear the horns punctuating that So What, you know, type of feel in the theme, the introductory part of the tune. And yet it is so meaningful. It has been so influential. So many people know that riff. So many people are familiar with that melody, and yet that is so typical of Miles that, you know, here's this great tune. He did keep it in his performance songbook for many years afterwards, but by the late 60s, he was moving on. And even, in fact, even after this album, he was moving on. And, you know, he would say, you know, I'm doing new stuff now, even though people would ask him to keep playing that live.
One of the things you write about in the book is that he, Miles, wasn't all that much into titles of things, and I think a lot of these actually didn't have titles when they were recorded.
No, in fact, none of them did.
So who decided that the title of this was So What?
Oh, definitely Miles.
Oh, he did, okay.
Because he would say that all the time, you know. He would say that to people, he would, you know, people, Miles, we got to do this, Miles, you know, we got to get a title for the album. So What?
And I'm sure he said it just like that, too.
Probably.
Yeah. Oh, we have a couple of callers. We'll try to get him in, and in the time that remains, we'll talk to someone in Chicago on line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you. I thought I'll offer personal experiences, having heard Miles play on occasion. The first time being was Dizzy Gillespie. He was sitting in the Dizzy here in Chicago when he played at some different venues around town. And Diz and Miles were always having a great time trading each other's horns and enjoying the different action of the valves, who had the smoothest, quickest valves and things. And also other occasions locally where Miles would come into some of the local areas where local bands were playing, and after hours, and everybody more or less left, and Miles would be up on the stage playing alone, solo, just sort of feeling his way through the free-form style that he later emulated and brought to a bear. Brought into the next level that he evolved into. But going back to the Birth of the Cool, I also appreciated the influences he had on other musicians. Like Jerry Mulligan was part of the Birth of the Cool, and of course Mel Torme had his wonderful vocal adaptation of that album, and others, and even Herb Alpert. Always talked to, if he could ever play the trumpet, it would be like Miles. And of course Ahmad Jamal said similarly, much of his runs and so forth and statements on the piano were right out of Miles' heart and feeling. So he did have a great influence on so many more that I don't want to take up the time to mention. But I always appreciated Miles for all the early things before the Birth of the Cool, like when he was playing with Bird especially. And thought I'd just offer those comments to you.
Sure. Well, Mr. Ghani, you talk about that any way
well,
you like.
Can I just admit to being extremely jealous that he caught Miles doing some solo performances there in Chicago? I mean, it's great to hear. I mean, these type of stories, these first-hand accounts, there's always something in them that I think are so valuable, and I try and insert that in my writing, actually, to try and get you, try and get the reader sort of "you are there now" type of feel. And the listener just mentioned Ahmad Jamal and how he was influenced by Miles. Well, there it went the other way around too. Miles was heavily influenced by Ahmad's trio sound and the conception of how he arranged certain tunes for a trio. And when Miles came through Chicago, he was always there checking out Ahmad Jamal. So, in fact, a lot of Miles' 50s repertoire was taken out of what Ahmad was playing. A lot of the ballads that he chose to play, Miles, you know, picked up and later re-recorded.
Yeah. On my my experience was when I was in college in the 1970s, early 1970s. This was Northern Illinois University at DeKalb. He came there and played, and I went and heard him. And the musicians assembled on the stage. Miles came out. He gave a sign, and there was this sort of explosion of music. It just started. They played without any kind of much of a break at all in terms of tempo and timbre and whatever for about, I don't know, 20 minutes, half an hour. Then he stopped them. He walked off. They took a break. He came back, and they did the second. They did this a second time, a second, essentially the same thing. They started playing, and then just played and played and played and played and played, and then they stopped.
Well, that total improvisatory way of approaching, you know, a sort of jam-like approach to creation really begins with the kind of Blue Album, with the way that he approached that in the studio. And that becomes more and more the way that he approaches this, you know, search for instant spontaneity, spontaneous improvisation, creation, etc. It really begins with the kind of Blue Project.
Yeah, and that was, I was glad that I saw him. I know I had this feeling that I was seeing somebody who really was a significant person, although he didn't seem to care much that we were there. That's what also the thing that you kind of hear about him is that he
yeah, that goes way back to the beginning of his career, the idea of his turning his back on the crowd. But if you listen to live recordings from back then, the crowd is talking so loudly that, of course, he would try and listen to his own band. He put together such great bands, such great lineups. Why wouldn't he focus more on that than trying to play the entertainer role?
Yeah, that's true. I guess I also, it makes me think of, I really, in addition to enjoying this record and a lot of other Miles Davis, I also am a fan of Bill Evans. And I think about was the Village Vanguard sessions that he did that were so influential, where you can hear all this, you hear glasses clinking and people moving plates around and people talking.
That's one of the classic examples of just how loud crowds were back then. Of course, now, sort of the opposite end is if you go to, especially here in New York, but I guess they're in Chicago too, certain clubs have almost a church-like reverence when you walk in that, you know, you never even hear anything. But back then, yeah, you were certainly doing battle with the idea that jazz was an entertainment background type of music.
Mm. Well, there, I think that we'll have to leave it for this time around. Definitely, if you have never heard this record, if it's been a long time, go out and play it again. I'm sure that you would enjoy it. Kind of Blue. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary, I guess that would be, and still we have about a couple of years yet to go.
Years.
2 years. It was recorded in 1959, and it still sounds just as good when it was first recorded, and certainly you can find it. And if you're interested in reading more about Miles Davis and his career, and particularly about this album and how it came together, this record, how it came to be made, you can look for Ashley Kahn's book, Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. It is published by DeCapo Press. And I'm sure if you keep listening to National Public Radio, now and again you'll hear him on there talking about music. Mr. Kahn, thanks very much.
David, this has been fun. Thanks for playing So What all the way through.
All right.